Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Commercial Connection Podcast. It is wonderful to have you here. Thank you for joining us. I am your host, Spencer Taylor with Mill Creek Commercial. And today, I think, is a topic that everyone doing a 1031 exchange will probably have. And we have our guest, Max Hansen, to help navigate these questions with us. Max is a managing director of Accruit LLC. He offices out of Dillon, Montana, and lives in Plymouth, Utah. That's quite the commute, Max.
Yeah.
He did his first exchange in 1978, several years before I was even a thought in my parents' mind. And he joined Accruit in 2018. He's one of the tallest QIs probably ever to walk the earth at 6'7". Max, thank you for being on the show. Great to have you.
It's great to be here, Spencer. I appreciate the opportunity to sit here and talk to you a little bit about some topics with regard to 1031 exchanges that keep coming up all the time in the business that we're in.
A couple questions for you. We'd love to know a little bit about your family. What brought you to Dillon, Montana? Montana's beautiful in every way. I'm looking at your background here, a head of a moose. I mean, just beautiful, beautiful part of the country. Why live in Utah? Why operate out of Montana? Kids, family, hobbies, that sort of thing. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, great. You know, the reason I ended up in Montana is because I was born and raised there. I was born and raised on a ranch southwest of Dillon, Montana. And I lived on the ranch, went to school there. I was telling you earlier that I went to school in the backyard of the ranch there with my brother, because the nearest other kids were about 20 miles away. And then I ended up also going to high school in Kalispell, Montana, which is up in the northwestern part of the state. Mm-hmm. Great area also. You know, worked up there out of high school, was a fire control officer and assistant fire control officer for the Forest Service for about 9 seasons there, and in Southern California out of Santa Barbara. So I definitely have had some experience dealing with a lot of the things that those folks in California and other places in the West, Oregon and Washington, are dealing with right now. But eventually went to law school in San Diego, graduated from there in 76, and went back to Dillon to practice law there in a small firm. And that's when I did my first exchange, 1978. I was a transactional attorney at the time, and started doing some transactional work because there were a lot of people that were buying ranch properties in Montana at that time, and my clients were wanting to do exchanges. And that was back in the old days when we really didn't understand how these delayed exchanges worked. They were all simultaneous transactions, and all the parties involved would be trying to get through the logistics of closing in one spot and on a relinquished property, and then acquiring replacement property someplace else, and trying to get it all to come together at one time. Mm-hmm. And it just evolved from that point on. I ended up starting my own exchange company in 91 because I'd been working with some qualified intermediary companies or exchange facilitators in California at that point, and wanted to get a little closer to home, but there wasn't anybody doing them in the Rocky Mountain region at that time on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So I formed American Equity Exchange and ran my law practice, and had about 8 employees from any given time that were doing exchanges with me. Probably started out doing 5 exchanges the first year in 91, and then went to the point where we were doing thousands of them in a year given period. And then in July of 2018, I had an opportunity to join Accruit. A friendly competitor of mine for many years, knew many of the people that worked there. And we made the transition, and they took some of my employees with me, and they ran office space for me in Dillon. Mm-hmm. And it allows me now to work out of that place and the home that I have there near the Beaver Head River, just a rock's throw from some of the best fishing in the world,
yeah,
which I never get to do because we're too busy doing exchanges. And then I have a place just between Riverside, Utah and Plymouth, Utah, about an hour north of Salt Lake. and I'm looking out the window here at my outdoor arena and a couple of my horses that are standing out there being lazy today. So that's kind of my deal. I ended up moving to Utah because I met a beautiful lady here by the name of Sheena, who I married in 15 years ago, coming up on our 15th wedding anniversary. And I have a daughter, a stepdaughter that's 24 years old, who has given us one grandson, she and her husband, and they live just down the road. And then I have a daughter that's 8 years old, who keeps us all on our toes. So that's a little bit about me.
That's wonderful. Is your family, so you're pretty outdoorsy.
Yeah.
Is your family?
My father-in-law, you know, has some ranch property out at Snowville and also at Promontory, just by the Golden Spike Memorial out there at the monument.
Yeah.
And get to help him a little bit. You know, we've got some rope and cattle of our own, and we've got some rope horses that we've raised and are raising and training. And like I said, they're just fat horses now. They're not really rope horses.
They're living the life.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So oftentimes a landlord is maybe would like to do a 1031 exchange, and the topic of related party comes up. Can I sell my relinquished property to a family member? Can I buy my replacement property from a family member? Help us understand the rules and regulations and what's safe harbor with related parties.
You bet. You know, the problem with related party transactions arose, back in probably the 80s, early 90s. And the problem arose because there were too many entities typically that were taking advantage of that situation. Mm-hmm. What they were doing is they were doing transactions between a parent corporation or some kind of a parent business entity and a subsidiary. And typically what they would do is they would have one property that the parent owned that had a low basis. And consequently, a sale of that property would result in a large capital gain and a capital gain tax. And the subsidiary would have perhaps a property that they acquired fairly recently that had a relatively high basis in it. So what those two entities could do would swap those properties. And then after they'd held it for a period of time, or after the subsidiary ended up with the property with the low basis, the parent entity ended up with the property with the high basis, they could turn around and sell that property with relatively small, you know, capital gain tax consequences.
Yeah.
And when Congress and the IRS Treasury figured out that there was some abuses going on, they kind of plugged that hole. There hadn't been any restrictions on it before. So what we see now is a basic rule that says whenever there's a transaction, an exchange transaction occurs between related parties, and within 2 years after the exchange, either party cashes out of the property that they've ended up acquiring in the swap or the exchange, and there's a basis shift, both parties' exchanges will be disallowed. And that's the way it stands right now. The related party is anybody who's really a lineal ancestor or descendant, a sibling. So we're talking about parents, children situations, children and grandparents, perhaps grandparents and grandchildren, siblings, brothers and sisters, and any entity that has a shared ownership of more than 50%, okay, 50% control.
Yeah.
Corporations with common control, transactions between trust grantors and trustees or beneficiaries of a trust.
Yeah.
So anytime there's a transaction between those related parties, and there's a basis shift and a cash out event within 2 years after that transaction takes place, the IRS can go back and disallow either or both sides of that deal.
Did you say they can disallow either or both sides?
Yeah. Yep.
So there's there could be a case where one of the exchanges is okay, is fine.
It may fly under the radar, but yeah. You know, keep in mind that there's always that possibility that both sides of the transaction could cash out. I mean, it could be disallowed. One of the things that, you know, the IRS has been a lot more lenient on those situations where a taxpayer sells a property to a related party and then exchanges into something with an unrelated party, just a typical exchange. And the reason for that is, for the most part, you're going to find that the person, the related party that bought the relinquished property from the taxpayer, has the intention of holding it for a period of time before they sell it or do some other transaction where there's a change in ownership. So it's not so rife with abuse as the situation with a forward exchange into property owned by a related party. That's where the big problems occur, and that's where the whole string of cases that you see all the way from a ruling back in 1997, which was kind of I call it the Mommy Tam ruling, because a taxpayer had sold a relinquished property, was looking around for replacement property, couldn't find anything that really fit the bill, so the taxpayer acquired the property from his mother. Mm-hmm. The mother, of course, cashed out. She used the money to go ahead and pay other bills, or perhaps even paid off some debt on the property. Yeah. And was able to pocket the cash and use it for other purposes. And the IRS disallowed that transaction. That was a tax advice memorandum that was issued in 1997. Mm-hmm. And there's been a whole string of cases on through the present. The most recent case is the Malalani Group case that took place here was finally decided a couple years ago in federal court, in which a similar transaction, obviously on a much bigger scale, took place, and there was a cash out event, basis shift, IRS disallowed it, and their decision was upheld. There's also some revenue rulings that were issued to flesh out the issues with these related party deals. There's one that's called, I call it Revenue Ruling 2002-83. That was kind of a related party situation. And there's been a number of private letter rulings issued during this span of time from 97 to the present that make it very clear the position that the IRS is taking on these types of deals.
So in the eyes of the law, IRS, that sort of thing, your intention matters a lot.
Yes, sir.
Right? Like you mentioned, there could be a farmer, 4 grown children, he's ready to retire, and he wants to sell his land and 1031 and exchange into something else, maybe like an apartment complex or something. But one of his children would like to buy it. Their intent would be, well, you know, I grew up here and I want to be a farmer.
Yes, and as I indicated before, we've seen a number of those types of transactions. And typically, I mean, in the case that you're, or in the facts pattern that you're talking about, there shouldn't be a problem with that.
Yeah.
You know, because the farmer's going to sell to one of his kids or all of his kids. They're most likely going to be holding that for the requisite purpose. That is a business use. That is farming, because farming is a business,
yeah.
And that satisfies that requirement. So it's acquisition of that property with the intent to hold it for a business purpose or an investment purpose. And there's not going to be a problem with that, because the farmer is then going to exchange into something else. He's not cashing out either. And that's the type of transaction that will work.
What does your intent need to be when you buy your replacement property from a related party? Same kind of intent, long-term buy and hold strategy?
Yeah, and let me just back up for a second and just talk just briefly about the definition of like-kind property, which is the standard that's used in 1031. 1031 like-kind property is defined as any property held for investment purposes or productive use in a trade or business. Mm-hmm. And essentially, that definition is wide open. It allows the taxpayer to exchange out of and into all kinds of different real property interests. You know, and it can range anywhere from Basically, it's anything that they're not going to immediately use as a personal residence or something that they're just going to flip within a short period of time.
Yeah.
So flippers, you know, people that are buying and selling property all the time are going to have a hard time meeting that standard.
Yeah.
With those types of transactions. And if somebody acquires a property and ends up using it for their own personal residential use within a couple of years, they're probably going to have a hard time defending that decision or defending that transaction. But keep in mind that people can exchange out of farm property and into commercial property. They can exchange out of commercial property into bare land. They can sell. I was in a couple seminars up in Montana last week. We talked about the sale of archaeological and paleontological rights, you know, where the right to somebody coming in and buying the ability to mine for dinosaur bones, you know, can be sold. And then the taxpayer takes that money from that transaction and exchanges into something totally unrelated to that.
Yeah.
So that having been said, I mean, the farmer in your situation could do that transaction with his kids, end up acquiring a multifamily residential property or a single family residential property, and you know, change his income stream, you know, from the ag sector to a completely different sector, which is what you folks are doing a lot of. I mean, it's a great opportunity for people, even if they're not getting completely out of the ranch business or the farm business. Mm-hmm. They're selling that type of property and acquiring a replacement property that you folks have gone out there and found. And they're able to acquire a DST interest in that or Delaware statutory trust interest in that property. And for the first time in multiple generations, they've got an income stream that's not related to the vagaries of what cattle prices are, what commodity wheat, corn prices are.
Yeah. So I want to back up because you mentioned something really interesting, and that's personal use. So oftentimes, a homeowner will buy, or a couple, a family will buy a home. Maybe it's their first home. They live in it, they use it, and then they move out, but they keep it as a rental or they turn it into an Airbnb, right? And
as an Airbnb,
you know, maybe they come and they use it 2 weeks out of the year or something, but they're still benefiting from it personally, right? If they use it personally, does it qualify as this income producing or business or trade definition inside of, hey, you can 1031 exchange out of like a VRBO that you use on occasion personally?
Yeah, let's take your example, or, you know, generally talking about your situation, but even the farmer we were talking about a minute ago. Say the farmer ends up acquiring a multifamily residential property or just a single family residential a rental property, and they end up VRBOing. It's in Carefree, Arizona, or it's in Prescott, or, you know, any number of places where they don't end up having to deal with winter anymore for a while.
Yeah.
And they end up VRBOing that property. There's a number of different rules to keep in mind with regard to those types of properties. And first one is that the IRS has never really cared if somebody uses a property for less than 14 days a year, you know, for their personal use. The idea was that, you know, if you have a rental property, a VRBO, Airbnb, whatever, and you're going in there and you're spending, you know, 14 days a year there, you're probably doing a lot of kind of odds and ends maintenance type stuff. And it's so de minimis that the IRS has never really cared about that.
Okay.
Because there are people that, you know, end up using it perhaps more than that, there has been an issuance of a revenue procedure. It's called Revenue Procedure 2008-16, in which the IRS further clarified personal use of 1031 property. Essentially said, you know, that we have the 14-day rule, but if you have a property that's in a rental pool, actually being rented out, and this is a general statement, mm-hmm. and there are some nuances to it, but I don't want to get into really into the weeds on that and confuse people. But if they use it for, they can use it for 10% or less of the time they actually have it rented out. So you can see that if somebody had something rented out for 11 months out of the year, they could be using it for almost 30 days out of the year without any problem. Okay. But it becomes a problem then if they're using it more than that. Now, something else to consider with regard to these types of properties is that a taxpayer can rent out a residential property to a related party, to a child, to their parents, and they can, as long as there's a written rental agreement and there's a fair market rent being collected from that related party can utilize the property, independent of whatever personal use the taxpayer has. Now, who knows who the related party has visiting from time to time, but there has to be a fair market rent, okay? And that's done, I think, quite a lot. And one of the problems that I think is probably out there right now is that there are a number of people that have properties that they were probably using on a very intermittent basis. They were well within the standards of the revenue procedure that I mentioned. But they, because of COVID-19, they ended up leaving large metropolitan areas where they were living and working, and ended up retreating to some place that they had formerly been renting out, you know. And so, I wonder just sometimes how much latitude the IRS is going to give people during this real kind of notable historic time in our lives. It would seem to make sense, you know, that maybe the rules would be relaxed, but I don't know about that. There's no indication that they would relax the rules on that. So bottom line is, you know, 14 days or less, or stay at least within the parameters of RevProc 2008-16, and have if you're renting it out to a related party, make sure it's within the parameters, that is not more than 10% of the time it's actually rented out. Have a written rental agreement with that related party, fair market rent collected. There's a possibility too that they could rent it to a business that they have, and use that business, I mean, have the business use it as a remote work location, mm-hmm. and or temporary residence for company employees.
Yeah.
You know, as long as there's fair rental being collected on it.
So I'm going to see how closely we can mingle personal use and the like kind definition. So let's say I own an apartment complex, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be a farmer. And so I sell my apartment complex and I 1031 exchange it to a farm. And the farm has a little farmhouse on there, just enough bedrooms for my five little kids. My wife, she wants to live there, right? Can we exchange into the farm and can we live on the farm?
Yeah, there's a number of different ways that can happen.
Uh-huh.
To go back to, and I always, here's another rule that I have. I'm always going to defer to the taxpayer's accountant or tax advisor, their attorney, their tax attorney, whomever. Okay, and the taxpayer is always going to have to get the green light from those folks. And if they do, then you know I'm happy to facilitate the exchange. But if you do that, if somebody in that fact situation buys the farm with the farmhouse, the first question that I ask is, you know, what did they do as far as coming out of the relinquished property? I mean, let's just assume it was like-kind property. It was commercial or business use property. It wasn't their personal residence. They're not. Right. They're using all exchange funds to acquire the farm, which includes the house.
Yes.
At that point, I would suggest, you know, that the taxpayer needs to talk with their accountant about the possibility of that farmhouse being employee housing and leased to a business entity that's either formed or in existence already. that would be in charge of operating the farm or ranch.
Which could be me and my family, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They could be employees. I mean, you could be employees. Yeah. And part and parcel of your job description requires you to reside there and to oversee everything that's going on there.
Interesting.
The other thing I suppose could take place would be to just rent it out for a couple of years, or let it sit vacant for a couple of years because you're in the process of making a transition anyway.
Yeah.
And do some advanced planning in that regard, and then end up commencing use as a personal residence after you've had it for a couple of years, or at least a couple of tax reporting periods, which could be two different timelines. So I think there's all kinds of possibilities out there, and given a little bit of advanced planning with the right people in the mix, it's something that, people can surely consider. And it's a real viable opportunity for them.
So I'm going to throw another scenario at you, because I think this is really interesting. And I think people kind of have these like off the beaten path questions. So let's say I sell my relinquished property. I don't live on it and I don't use it for any personal use. Let's just say that for example, and I buy an apartment complex, and this is a large apartment complex. And let's say we're retired. We don't have any kids. We want to live in our own apartment complex.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same kind of rules as the farm scenario? If I don't want to be the maintenance guy, if I don't want to manage the property, I just want to live in the property that I own. And maybe there's 100 units on this apartment complex. Can I take one of those units as my own personal residence if I did a 1031 exchange into it?
And again, the same rules would apply in that situation with an apartment complex. The taxpayer ends up acquiring the property as part of the 1031 exchange. Uh-huh. And then either because they're an employee of the company that owns it, they're responsible for residing there and managing it for a period of time. And then at some point in time, they relinquish their management responsibilities and just end up residing there. And take it one step further, they could reside there for five of them, and then decide that they're going to condo those apartment units out, okay, so that they become condo units, and they're in a situation there where they could sell the condo unit that they resided in as their personal residence, use the 121 exclusion to defer up to $500,000 gain on the sale of that condo unit, and acquire, take that money and put it in the bank and move into the unit next door.
Max, this is why a great 1031 accommodator, a QI, is probably a landlord's secret weapon.
Yeah, I agree. Spencer, what I've always told people, from the very beginning, as a qualified intermediary, I can't really give tax advice.
Uh-huh.
Or legal advice to people. And I've always told them that my job is just to make sure that I get you steered in the right direction. So if you don't have a CPA, or a good attorney on the transactional or tax side, I'm going to try to get you, I'm going to encourage you as the taxpayer to get one.
Yeah.
So that you have some basis for making the decisions you do in some of these nuanced approaches to 1031s that we've been talking about. I've always said too, one of the other things that I do as a qualified intermediary is to draw good roadmaps for IRS agents.
Yeah.
And so that if the IRS agent looks at the transaction and they can see that the taxpayer simply traded property A for property B and they never got any of the money that was created as a result of that transaction. It was held by a qualified intermediary company and used simply to acquire the replacement property, that there's generally going to be a good exchange.
Yeah.
And when they go to report that transaction in the next tax reporting period or at the end of the tax reporting period, that it's going to withstand scrutiny. Because I don't want anybody's exchange to go bad because the I's weren't dotted, the T's weren't crossed.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the job of the QI company.
Well, so I think the communication between you, the QI, their accountant, maybe their attorney, you know, you're giving them perspective on a very limited and niche area of the tax code, which, I mean, I don't know. I don't think CPAs fully understand, like, all the rev proc, all the different safe harbor of 1031, and together you and their CPA, well, you can understand, okay, what's in the best interest of the taxpayer, what should they be doing, what's the strategy when they move into this, you know, farmhouse or whatever, and you should be talking with their CPA.
Yeah, and thanks now to the, used to be I use faxes a lot. But I've got methods files that go back 30 plus years now on exchange issues, and I can just click or copy a link and send them a link on something that's either, you know, all they have to do in many instances, I just refer them to something that's on the Accruent website, mm-hmm. www.accruent.com.
Yeah, perfect.
There's all kinds of information in there written by me and another cohort of mine by the name of Martin Edwards. Yeah. Who's got the same amount of experience, you know, in exchanges probably as I do. He's got as many years under his belt. We've got another guy by the name of Jordan Bourne, who's a transactional attorney for 12 years that came on board with Marty and works out of our Chicago office. And we ended up hiring another great guy, a great friend of mine by the name of David Gordonberg,
yeah,
who is headquartered out of Philadelphia. And David, you know, is another former past president of the Federation of Exchange Accommodators. And, you know, he's just been actively involved in exchanges, has been his business. And so you're right. There are many accounts that, you know, I'll talk to, or they have talked to their client and said, and no offense to accounts, okay?
Yeah.
I like to have them in the loop. I really think they need to be in the loop from the get-go. But there's some of them that think if you sell a piece of farm ground, you've got to buy more farm ground.
Yeah.
Or if you sell a commercial building, you have to buy another commercial building. That, you know, is more of a similar use standard that you see in 1033 involuntary conversions, like eminent domain cases or condemnation cases or insurance losses, that type of thing. Okay. But there's even been a relaxation of that standard, you know, because of 1031G, you know, in which basically that like-kind standards now apply to some involuntary conversion cases involving condemnations, where people can actually, they're not bound by that similar use standard. So again, you know, a lot of times we just work really hard to get accountants and attorneys up to speed, because obviously we've done thousands and thousands of exchanges, and this may be the, you know, fourth or fifth one they've done in their entire career.
So as we wrap up here, Max, we're very appreciative of your time. Thank you for sharing all that you know. I mean, I think everyone needs to know this. Related party, personal use, very, very informative. What advice would you give the landlord who's maybe owned a property for a while, ready to retire, and they haven't listed a property, but they're thinking about selling? What advice would you give that kind of landlord?
I would tell them, you know, to think about the possibilities.
Yeah.
To don't foreclose opportunities.
Yeah.
Because they may be dealing with something that's a different property type than they were formerly using. Mm-hmm. Case in point, talked to somebody last week who was selling a property that's a vacation rental. And it's worked out well for them because they live in the same general area. And so she and her husband have been able to take care of that property, you know, use VRBO or Airbnb, and had a great clientele renting that property out from them. Were able to mow the lawn and do all the stuff that they needed to do to keep it up to date. But they're both, you know, professional people. They've got a young family. Mm-hmm. They're too busy to deal with the four T's, the toilets, tenants, trash, and termites. and they're ready to do something different. And, you know, so, you know, there's the opportunity they have to get into Delaware statutory trust interests. You know, that's a different type of property. There's different issues associated with those. I mean, you know, they're going from owning one property that they have control of, that they can go up and, you know, mow the lawn on the weekend, to something that they're not going to have to deal with the active management issues.
Yeah.
And they're part of an owner group. Okay. So there's other people that they're making decisions with about the hold period and when that property eventually sells. But once they get over that threshold issue and can wrap their head around that, and that's where you guys come in. I mean, that might be a great opportunity for them to deal with those issues that I just talked about. The fact that they're busy, they don't have time to do the active management issues. Yeah. They've got kids. They don't want to be involved in mowing the lawn and doing all the maintenance and cleaning the place up and getting the linens cleaned up for the next visitor that weekend. They want to spend the weekend going to softball games with their kids or going down to St. George or wherever, you know, and spend a little bit of downtime themselves.
Max, we're Mill Creek. We offer tenant in common interests, which are very similar to DSTs. But
I was going to add that DST interest or tenancy in common interest.
Yeah.
There are many instances in which that TIC format that you guys, you know, may be easier for people to deal with than a DST interest.
Yeah. If someone calls you, Max, you take their questions, right?
You bet.
How can they get a hold of you?
800-237-1031.
I love it.
My wife cussed me out the other day because a lot of people have my cell phone number. All you got to do is, you can Google me probably and get my cell phone number. If you dial that 800 number and you just ask for me, there's going to be somebody that'll get you through to me. But more importantly, there's a whole raft of people there. Like I mentioned Marty Edwards, I mentioned Jordan, David Gornberg. Yeah. We have a staff of client service people that we were adding it up the other day. We probably have approaching 200 years of cumulative experience in the 1031 field within the subject matter experts that I mentioned, plus the CSAs or the client service administrators. Maritza, Asher, Michelle, Shanda. Shanda in our office and Dylan, Shanda Turner, does a lot of reverse exchanges for us. And that may be a topic for another discussion.
Sure.
But I tell people that Shanda Turner, who's been with me almost 20 years now, probably knows more about reverse exchanges than 95% of the attorneys and accountants in the United States.
Fascinating.
So great team of people. And I'm sure they'll get their questions answered.
Well, Max, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
I wish we could enjoy a meal. This week would have been our Federation of Exchange Accommodators annual event. We go, we went last year. We're going to go every year moving forward. I wish we could have grabbed a meal together.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll do, Spencer. It's going to happen. And sometime you just let me know. I'll meet you at Maddox in Logan or Ogden, or I'll even come down to your neck of the woods down there in the big city, you know.
Well,
us country folk, we get a little nervous when we have to go to the big city, but I made that trip a lot, so it doesn't bother me anymore.
What's there to eat? What's your favorite place to eat in Dillon?
In Dillon?
Yeah.
There's a place called The Den in Dillon, which is probably one of the better restaurants around the country. Great place. Actually, the people that own it now exchanged into it. So, and my cousin ends up running it. So that's always a go-to place. But we've got the Mexican taco bus there too. And people drive all the way from Bozeman, Montana to Dillon to just eat at the Mexican taco bus and go to the Patagonia outlet store, which is just two doors down the street from my office building there.
So Max, just a full disclosure here, I'd rather go up to Dillon and eat where you want to eat than have you come down into the smog of the Salt Lake Valley.
Hey. It's all good. You've got some great restaurants. In fact, my wife's birthday is coming up Friday, and so she's lobbying really hard for me to go to Walter's Osteria.
Oh yeah. You need to.
Yeah. Well, I know I've been there before. I'm a great proponent for Walter. I mean, I'll go down there just to get a hug from Walter.
Wonderful. Well, Max, thank you, and to all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us. If you haven't already, like our page. Like this episode and share it. There's someone you know that is kicking tires and figuring out if they should do a 1031 exchange. Max Hansen will be a perfect resource for them. I know.
Great.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
TICs forever. Tenants in Commons forever.
Thank you. And until next time, have a wonderful day.
Thanks a lot.